Awesome. So welcome to What Makes Sharing Platforms Thrive. My name is Neil Gornflow, publisher of Shareable Magazine. And this is our agenda for today, and we want to try to mix it up, you know, have an even mix of panel discussion and Q&A. There's our hashtag. And I want to give, you know, to kick it off, give a little bit of context of why this is important and what we're going to talk about. And first I want to ask you a question. Raise your hand. How many of you have heard at least one of these terms up here? Wow, that's great. So a big difference from last year in our panel. That's awesome. So I want to give a little bit of a definition of the sharing economy, because that's really Shareable Magazine's point of view. And what we see happening in the world is a paradigm shift in the operating system of society, a transition from a top-down factory model of society to a peer-to-peer network model of society. And this affects everything, how we produce, how we consume, how we govern, and our society and our economy is being restructured in many ways according to the architecture of the internet. And this has profound implications. And in context of South by Southwest Interactive, to think about this in the evolution of the internet. So we started out as hooking people up to the internet into information, and then we hit the Web 2.0 stage, hooking connecting people to people, and now we're after sort of doing a lot to revolutionize the media industry and things that can be easily digitized. Now we're into and moving past sort of the low-hanging fruit of what the internet and how disruptive it can be. Now we're moving into a phase where our physical world now is being restructured through network technologies and mobile technologies. And our concern today is to talk about the consumption part of that shift in the sharing economy. And these are some of the leaders in this space. We have Relay Ride, Shelby's here. We've got Park at My House, which is a parking sharing application, Loose Cubes, where you can find a workspace wherever you are, get a spare cube or find a co-working space. We have Airbnb, which is peer-to-peer accommodation. Zipcar, which is sort of a model for the sharing economy and has been around for a long time. So some of the things in the sharing economy are old and some are very new. And in the last couple of years, I would say starting off in 2008, 2009, an explosion of these types of companies started to emerge, driven by the economy, by new mobile technologies, a shift to smartphones, environmental concerns, and people also wanting to have community again and needing really to rely on one another in a lot of ways. The reason why this is important, I think actually the question of this panel is maybe the most important question here at South by Southwest, because when you think of the challenges we face, the crisis we face as a species, when you think that of the Earth and as a finite resource, and we have growing population and also growing per capita consumption, especially with India and China coming on and a middle class rapidly growing, it becomes, I mean, at least to me, it has become glaringly obvious that we need to learn how to share on a mass scale or share or die. That's the title of our new book. And so it's really, I think it's critical. And what this community is doing, what these companies are doing, and the sharing economy, this should be really at the center of our discussion about how to create a society that can last and that can sustain. And to me, it's really surprising that it hasn't moved to the center. But I feel like it is also. And I feel like people are starting to recognize that sharing is really super important and a core solution. And this kind of explains a little bit of the challenge that that we need, the challenge facing us globally, which is we really need to cool down the planet, but also raise 2 billion people out of poverty. It's kind of a little bit depressing, but on the one hand, we're using about 1.5 planets worth of resources annually that the Earth can generate, and it's not caring for about 2 billion people on the planet. So a third of the global population are sort of left out, even though we're using more than we have, kind of, and eating into our natural capital. So we need to do both. We need to raise, if we want a stable global civilization, we need to cool the Earth down and raise 2 billion people out of poverty. And sharing, I think, has a shot at doing this. So what are the and just to use car sharing as an example, I'll share some stats on car sharing and what it does. The dynamics there is one shared car replaces 13 owned cars, 9 to 13. And also, if in a city, so if you're a mayor, like one of the smartest things that you can do to build the local economy is go to a sort of multi-mode transportation system and move away from a car-based one. For every 15,000 owned cars you take off the road, you can keep an estimated $127 million in the local economy. And then the other thing is like, you can, by sharing and using platforms to help people share, you can increase access to assets. So there's a kind of a social justice component here. In the latest research, it showed that 50% of people joined car sharing to get access to a car that didn't already have access. At the same time, 25% of people who joined got rid of a car. So you can radically reduce resource consumption, build a local economy, and give people broader access to the assets they need to lead their everyday life. So this is a solution that hits at many problems. It's very strategic, and it really acts at the core of the kind of the problems that we see in the world, economic and social and environmental. And so this kind of sets the context for our discussion. And first, let's introduce the panel. So this is Christopher. I'm going to botch the name again, but Lukasic of Airbnb. So the largest, I think, peer-to-peer accommodation site. And you do the communications function there. And we have Shelby Clark, founder and chief community officer of Relay Rides, which just launched a nationwide peer-to-peer car sharing. So congratulations, Shelby. That's awesome. We have Jamie Shea of the University of Michigan Venture Fund. And we have Anne Miracot, which founder and managing partner of Floodgate, a VC firm that invests in companies and platforms that help people share resources. And so let's kick off the discussion. I want to, because Shareable Magazine and the University of Michigan and working with Jamie, we did some research around this to kind of figure out, what can people do? What are some points that we can share that can help people build sharing platforms that can really take off and bring this into the mainstream? So Jamie, tell me about the research we did, so the basics, and then we'll talk about some of the key points.
Sure. So as Neil said, I'm a dual degree grad student at the University of Michigan in the School of Natural Resources and also at the business school. And I guess part of it is the most interesting element of actually, I think, all of the research was actually the process of getting to where we were going and trying to answer the question, like, what makes asset sharing platforms thrive? So Neil and I talked about it last summer, and one of the goals of the study was to actually come up with something which could be broadly applied across all of the different categories, whether it was cars, rooms, tools, whatever it might be. And that actually proved to be one of the larger challenges. There's been a lot of great work that Lisa Gansky did, that Rachel Botsman did, and that Neil continues to do in terms of the overall sort of big picture sharing economy. But as you actually start to get into the process and start to try to analyze all of these different businesses, the companies, and the platforms, it actually became very clear to me that beyond the broad level, it became very difficult to draw broad conclusions beyond what had already been done. When you start looking at it, sort of car sharing starts to have what makes car sharing platforms successful actually relates a lot to sort of the transportation and mobility industry in and of itself, which is different than necessarily the sort of the lodging and transportation or the lodging industry. And so I sort of was doing a lot of, you know, work thinking, had my, you know, business hat on and thinking on the industry side of it, and was really sort of just spinning, going in circles for a while. And then all of a sudden I put on sort of my school of, you know, my environmental hat. And a lot of the work that I do on the environmental side is looking at sort of how do we create the conditions under which people make environmentally responsible decisions and behavior. And one of the things that we think about is one of the terms that we use is our interventions and behavior change interventions. And what you can think of that is just a program. Like, for example, recycling, and when we used to, at least on the East Coast, in order to promote recycling, we actually had to pay people to recycle. So you can think of like the 5 and 10 cents, you know, recycling, that's a behavior change intervention. And it started to occur to me that actually sharing platforms are some of the most robust and sort of unique sharing platforms that have ever been developed. And so in looking at it, trying to understand what makes, you know, sharing platforms thrive, I started realizing that there's actually, rather than looking, one of the challenges I'd say to back up is that this, a lot of what the sharing economy is doing and a lot of the platforms are trying to do is promote behavior change. You know, there's so much discussion at the moment about big data, all the data exhaust, which is coming off of our online internet use. But that's really great. It's okay, based on our past actions, how does that predict our future actions? Well, what happens when you actually want to change your future actions? How do you actually use data, and how do you actually sort of try to understand, you know, how do you understand what makes these, you know, platforms thrive? And so there's actually, what I started realizing, there's about 30 years of academic research looking at environmentally driven behavior change interventions. And I started realizing, you know, there's actually a ton of things. You can actually map all of this research onto the sharing economy, onto these platforms, to get an understanding of what makes a platform thrive. And that's useful for someone like Shelby, who's already, and for Chris, who they already have great, robust sites. How do you improve them? It's useful for someone like Ann, who's looking at sort of how do you sort of identify what are the best areas to invest in, or someone who's starting something new, whether it's, you know, a for-profit model or a community model. And if a bunch of you have handouts, and I could go on like on this for a very long time, and we'll sort of hopefully it can be drawn out through the questions. But one of the most interesting things is like, what are the things that drives us are our social norms, and sort of like, what is it that our community is doing that has a huge impact on what actually we decide to do? And I think what's interesting about the online platforms is that it's created a new sense of community for us. So if you live in San Francisco and you want to, you know, you're looking toward your peers to understand what it is that I should be doing, well, I think a lot of them are going to sort of have a mentality of being environmentally responsible, of looking out for the community. That's different necessarily than from where I grew up in New York City. And it's not to say that New Yorkers don't care about the environment, but it may not be to the degree that it exists on the West Coast. But if all of a sudden through, you know, the idea of like social media and our online connections has reshaped our idea of community, and I think it's really interesting that Shelby's actually, you know, as a founder, is focused on the community aspect of Relay Rides, because all of a sudden your community and what the social norms are that are driving you to make your decisions can be redefined. And so someone who's in an area which may not have a social norm which is directed toward, you know, environmentally responsible behavior or sharing can actually find support within a new community that either Relay Rides creates, that Shareable creates. And that's just one aspect of the research. That's something that's when you can have those, a strong community, and it supports this behavior, yep, that's something that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. So Jamie, pull out a couple of the stats, like what really popped out for you. I mean, first I want to acknowledge that that's a really great framework and one that really hasn't been talked about in the sharing community, and I think it's really valuable. So what popped out for you in the research?
I think what really popped out for me, if you turn over the page, there's a bunch of different research, is that is thinking about the difference between, again, a lot of it is the research is being able to look at a difference between, it helps me focus where, or helps me think about where someone like Shelby or someone like Chris wants to focus their efforts. I think one of the interesting things here is, and just the top two panels or talks of stage of change, that 50% of our respondents had actually used car sharing. And so it was, you know, there were people who was part of the sharing community and part of our, it was a demographic which might be more predisposed to actually to share. But the second, on the right-hand side, you can see that the number of people that were aware of car sharing and that were considering doing it was actually 50% of the respondents that actually weren't necessarily actually taking the action. So I think a lot of what was interesting to me is that we can, a lot of us are at a stage where we have a intent and we have a desire to share, but we're not actually following through with the behavior.
Right.
And so what was interesting to me is that just recognizing how many people are on the cusp and wanting to share, but just because of the barriers that are set up, whether it's convenience or cost, which you can see at the bottom of the page, those are things that are holding them back. And we all feel it, I think, in our lives. It's like we have this desire, we have a desire to lead more responsible lives, but we don't actually follow through on it. And there's a lot of reasons for it. But I think the folks that are, you know, Shelby and Chris and everyone else that's developing these platforms are breaking down those barriers to make it much easier for us to actually follow through on our behavioral intent and turn it into a real action.
Right, right. And breaking down those barriers, too, can kind of be an expensive exercise as well, right?
Yeah.
So, therefore, the value of the research. And this stat here, you know, 50% of people are aware of it and considering car sharing, that points to a pretty big market potential there. And Shelby, I thought I'd ask you about what's the market potential there for car sharing and peer-to-peer?
Well, I mean, I think it's absolutely enormous for car sharing. What, you know, people always ask us, you know, is Zipcar, you know, how do you think Zipcar? Are they one of your big competitors? And, well, of course, you know, we both provide, you know, access to vehicles on a short-term basis. But I think it would be a big mistake for us to be focusing on, you know, trying to steal a couple of Zipcar's customers. You know, Zipcar's, they've been growing really fast. It's, you know, at one point recently it was a $1 billion company. And, but they have less than 1 million members worldwide. And, you know, there's 260 million cars on the road in the United States. More cars than drivers. There's 1.2 cars for every driver. So, you know, what we're really playing in here is it's transportation, it's mobility. It's not just car sharing or car rental. And so, you know, I think that, you know, as an industry, as we can work together to provide more and better options that make car sharing a better alternative to car ownership, that there's an enormous opportunity. There's been some research recently that suggested that by 2016 there'd be over 4 million car sharing members in the United States alone, and globally, you know, revenues over $10 billion. And this is really just looking at dense urban areas, so probably,
right,
you know, 10 to 15 cities in the United States. As you mentioned, Relay Rides just launched nationwide. So, you know, I think that we're definitely going to see, you know, a lot of activity in these urban cores where car sharing is already growing. But I think the market is so much bigger. You know, everybody needs to get around.
Right, like car sharing is tiny right now, right?
Yeah.
Compared to the automotive industry.
Right.
Yeah. And so how do, like, what's your perspective then? You know, you just launched this thing. You've obviously probably done a lot of thinking about, like, how do we bring peer-to-peer car sharing or car sharing into the mainstream from a sort of urban, cool, hip, urban thing to do to, like, you know, mom and dad in the suburbs are going to do it too.
Sure. So there's sort of three main things that we're thinking about to really bring car sharing much more into the mainstream. One is nothing new. It's trust and safety. And then the next things are more about bringing to the mainstream. So trialability and just access. So I'll talk about trust and safety first. And those very much are different things.
Right.
They're sort of grouped together. But safety is, you know, sort of about, for us, it's about you know, providing sort of the safeguards to, you know, to really keep people safe. So we have an insurance policy that covers the car owner. It's always the very first question that anybody asks us. What happens if somebody crashes my car? And so, you know, we're standing there and we'll take care of people, you know, if something does happen. Trust is something that is much more different. That's much different. I think trust is really it really stems from a strong community that really fosters a safe, well lit marketplace.
Right.
There's actually some interesting things that are going on across the industry of sharing that are really concerned about trust. And so reputation becomes very important. So, you know, how did Neil treat my car whenever he rented it? And what's interesting is, you know, that's actually a pretty good predictor of how Neil would treat Chris's apartment if he stayed on Airbnb. And so a couple of friendly faces in the audience, we have Lauren and Shin, who are actually both working on reputation platforms that sort of span the entire sharing economy.
Right, there's Trust Cloud, there's a bunch that kind of came on the scene just in January, right?
Yep, Trust Cloud, Project Trust, and then Legit, Git scaffold. So there's, you know, it's interesting to see sort of all these things that are happening to really support trust and safety, but it's something that's really important for us. So you know, this is nothing new, and you know, I think this is sort of a requisite of bringing things to the mainstream. So then some of the other things we're thinking about, so trialability. Previously there was a bit of a barrier to joining Relay Rides. We had these member cards that we screen your driving record and we have to mail you a member card. So it wasn't sort of an instant access sort of thing. And with the cars, when you were enrolling a car, we had to install a little device in the car. And so
right.
Not a huge barrier, but there was a barrier. And so what we tried to do is to make it super easy to use. So we did a... one thing we did was a really exciting partnership with General Motors. So we tied in with their safety and security platform OnStar, and so any GM car owner can sign up and link their OnStar and their RelayReds accounts.
Right.
So when you have a GM car reserve, you can just walk up and unlock it using your mobile phone.
How many cars have OnStar?
15 million.
And that's what percent of the market?
I think about 17% of, did I say something? 17% of all of the cars on the road are GM cars. So and when you think about 10,000 cars in Zipcar and 15 million cars that are eligible for this program, you know, it's pretty staggering. And it's a huge opportunity. So actually, we haven't launched this partnership quite yet. It's coming up really soon. But we do have a fleet of a dozen Volts down here where we have the integration working. And so if you tweeted us at Relay Rides and tell us you want to drive a Volt, we'll see if we can if we can get you one for free and actually dropped off right to your door. So give us a shout if you're interested in trying that out. And then, you know, this also really ties in with the trust and safety. You know, OnStar, it means trust and safety. That's what
right.
the brand has been developed on. And so working with a big company like that can really help. And the last thing is just access. So this is why it's been really important for us to get out of Boston and San Francisco. Those are markets that you know that really understand car sharing. It works really well. But for us, the challenge is you know how do you bring this to more people who haven't been using it, and how do you It's really simple. You're not going to use car sharing if it's not available. So
right.
You know,
right. If you go on Relay Rides, there's got to be like. Cars near you,
yes.
Right? You got to see,
yep.
Right? So there's a sort of like, it's a double-sided market, right? A two-sided market. So you got to build your inventory up,
yep.
And also your users coming to the site. Cool. So I want to come back to you, Shelby, but let's go to Anne. Tell us, Anne, what do you look for in the companies you know, what's a good investment for you?
Yeah. So. I think the fact that the VC is on the panel indicates that, you know, rapacious capitalism is still at work here as well, beyond sort of, you know, the feel-good reasons for being part of the sharing economy. We actually stumbled upon the sharing economy as an investment thesis. So one of our early investments was Chegg. And it actually was Craigslist for colleges when we first invested in it, and then it sort of turned into textbook rentals. And one of my first board meetings that I attended was the most interesting one that I've ever attended. It was sort of, you know, one of the questions that I always ask is, how do you do demand creation? And they said, you know, that's not the problem. We're turning away 85% of our orders because we can't keep up with the demand. And that was the first moment where I realized that this kind of renting or sharing kind of business could be extraordinarily profitable and interesting, and that the consumer was really interested in it. And so beyond that, what we started looking at was we made investments in Zimride, TaskRabbit, and also in Liquid Space. And if you look at sort of the notion of what the sharing economy means, it seems like this really new idea. But then you look at actually in the business world, right, where developers are using Amazon. And I was sort of looking at the things that the logos that were up on the board there a minute ago, and I was sort of surprised Amazon's not up there, right? And Amazon is probably the best sharing economy example, where you have EC2, and businesses don't even think twice about it. And so from my perspective, I was really interested in how businesses actually would end up using the sharing economy. And that's one of the foundations for our investment in Liquid Space, because we think that, you know, space is an idea that a lot of people are really willing to share, especially on the business level. And there's already a lot of trust. There's already a lot of behavior leading to people wanting to have extraordinary flexibility with respect to their resources. And so that's, I think, in terms of where people will adopt first and foremost, I'm actually very bullish on the business-to-business side. I do think that the consumer side is quite interesting. It's an extraordinarily large market. We've invested there because we believe that, you know, the concept of the neighborhood is changing. This is something that we're talking about a lot. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of elements that still keep people from doing it. I think when we talk about in board meetings, what are the competitors out there? You can list all the other startups in your space, but at the end of the day, the thing that consumers are deciding to compare against your startup choice is life as usual, right? And awareness, even though these numbers suggest that there's a lot of awareness, I would suggest that if you look at even Google search results, so if the day when searching becomes, SEM becomes a great way of demand creation for your product, then we'll know actually that awareness is growing. But I would suggest that it still isn't a highly trafficked search volume, right, for a lot of these terms. And so it's still awareness that we're really fighting against. It's not that someone is sitting there thinking about, you know, should I drive today or should I borrow someone's car on a platform? They're just sort of going ahead and driving. And so I think that's the major challenge, but I think that's also the major opportunity. I love seeing these environments where you have a lot of green space. And so that's been the major reason behind our investment thesis there.
Yeah, and that leads in nicely. Shelby, I wanted to ask you, like, what are the main motivations for people trying out relay rides and peer-to-peer car sharing?
Sure. So, I mean, I think, like Ann said, people have the routines that they're going about. I mean, everybody, they get around today. It's not like they're just, you know, sitting at home. And so they have to start with some sort of pain, you know, in terms of finding convenient, affordable access to transportation.
Yeah, and cars are like, what, the second highest household expense, right?
Yeah, it's usually the second most valuable asset you own and the second sort of biggest expense for households.
Yeah, it's like $8,000 or $9,000 a year for Americans.
$7,000 to $8,000 is the average.
So there's a lot of pain. There's a lot of pain. Opportunity there.
There's a lot of pain there. I think what's interesting is that usually people adopt car sharing around sort of what's been called a trigger event. So a change in their life where they have to reevaluate their transportation. They move. They get married. They get a job.
Or they lose one.
Or they lose one. Exactly. So finding convenient, affordable access. It's about convenience and economics to sort of get their attention, and then I think what sort of keeps people going or what gets them sort of really passionate about it actually shifts. So it becomes much more of the community and the environment. So we hear a lot of car owners talking about how, so Neil gave out one stat about car sharing for why it's good for the environment. The average shared car takes 13 cars off the road. The other thing that it does is it causes people to drive less. So the average person, so cars are expensive to own but cheap to drive, relatively cheap to drive. I mean, gas is getting more expensive, but it's more or less a fixed cost. And so car sharing, on the other hand, it's completely variable. Every time you get in a car, you feel that economic pain and you think twice before you drive. And so people drive less. You know, they walk more, they bike more, they take public transit. It's a really healthy change, and on average, people drive about 40% less.
Right.
And for the community, people really like the fact that their money is going right into the pocket of a neighbor. it's developed this really interesting concept of neighbors helping neighbors, where car owners feel like they're helping renters by providing a way to get around, and renters feel like they're supporting their neighbor, or helping their neighbor by providing them income, almost like supporting a local business. And so you have this really interesting symbiotic sort of interaction. And so a lot of times it's the sort of environmental or the community aspects that keep people really excited or sort of keep them engaged. But it's really that sort of the pain, the economics that really gets their attention and causes the change in behavior.
Right. A lot of the stories that we write about on Shareable about sort of personal narratives around sharing, a lot of times people come to, they might start Relay Rides or Airbnb because of an economic need, right? But then they find out that it's actually like a really cool experience. Like they have, it beats sort of like, not only save money or can make money by participating, but it could be more fun. You can connect with community. And it can be sort of better than the corporate sort of purchase or experience. And so I wanted to ask, go to Chris now and ask you, because like it's really interesting because so Shelby's Relay Rides just gone nationwide, mm-hmm. On the brink, I think, on the cusp of really breaking out now with that kind of footprint and the intention and the partnerships you have, Google, GM, right? But Airbnb is almost on the other side of the curve now, you've sort of jumped the chasm perhaps. You've had explosive growth. Chris, can you point to like a couple of decisions that your team at Airbnb made to like really choose the growth?
Certainly. I'm going to borrow your microphone.
Let's share.
Yes, it's true. I actually shared a taxi on the way here, which I found quite ironic given that I was coming to a sharing talk. But I think, and we're now in 192 countries around the world. And, we've been international almost from day one. I think the key decision that we made very early on was one that we wanted to build a long-standing business. And by making that decision, you can start to focus on the right things. And when you recognize that trust and safety are sort of, the paramount sort of factor to make this kind of new economy emerge, you have to take a very long-term approach to that because building trust and safety takes a long time. Building, trust with your users and building a community takes a very long time. Communities are not something that you can build overnight. There's this idea of an online community, which we've never viewed as sort of, the true, sort of the true genesis of what community is all about. So for us, it's very much about meeting our users and getting to know them. I think from day one, that became one of the most important things to the company is we actually need to go and spend time with our users. Not only to learn from them in order to innovate and be, a company that's pushing forward even from a technology standpoint and making sort of the fundamental sort of product decisions that we need to build trust and safety, but also that when you go and you meet your users, you build a rapport with them, you start to realize what their pain points are, and they start to trust you more. And we've done that from day one. We just opened 10 offices around the world. And the reason we opened 10 offices now, when we already have these thriving communities there, isn't to necessarily to grow the community as much as it is to foster community with the people that are there. And that's been, from day one, that's been the most important thing is sort of leaving the computer and going out and actually meeting your users. And that goes from customer service all the way through to product development. So,
right. Yeah. And I also, I learned that you guys have like community managers all over the world. Like, tell us about your program. Like, how does that work? Like, what are you doing? Like, what is a community manager? I know there's one, Jade in Austin, actually. Yeah. What does she do?
So a community manager at Airbnb has a number of responsibilities, but mostly it's that kind of core tenet is to foster and build community, and that can come in a number of ways, through education events, through social events, or literally just being the phone number that someone in the Austin community has should something go wrong. Right? Or should they have a question about something? Should they need, they'd be out of town and they can't drop the key off for a guest. Having someone from our company there that's not, a customer service agent. This is a friend, right? This is someone who is sort of there, to foster and spur community, in a local economy. And we've done this, even with our customer service. The majority of our customer service representatives now are actually or were users of the site. Most of them were hosts, considering that's sort of the biggest kind of touch point for our customer service team. So we've actually hired from within our community, in order to kind of build and support the business, because what we recognize we're building is not a business, that we're sort of just there to kind of foster this idea of community, because we're a two-sided marketplace. And as a business, we don't function without either side. And it's important, for us to kind of see our role in that, not as one of being, business and sort of consumer, but one as being sort of, socially responsible for fostering community and then building sort of from a product and a business standpoint, the platform that makes this possible, because this is something people already want to do.
Yeah, that's rad that you have like people on the ground. It's like a concierge, but more.
Yeah, in a way.
Yeah, maybe that's the wrong word though. You don't like that word, concierge.
We have a concierge program, but see, that's sort of different.
Okay, so I feel like we've set some good context and let's open it up for Q&A. The way I'd like this to run is, if you have a question, the priority is going to be on people who come to the mic. And then Paul Davis, raise your hand, Paul. Paul Davis is our tech editor at Shareable, and he's going to monitor the Twitter stream. If there's a question that's coming for that, he might jump in and pose the question, Twitter question to the panel.
Maybe just to start things off.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah. So Beraltz on Twitter once had a question. For consumer collaborative consumption businesses, what are the best practices to create a sense of neighborhood and community with non-local sharing and or swapping? And if you're here, maybe you can expand. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm just curious about, you were talking about physical goods with car sharing and then location sharing. And for companies that are looking to perhaps go downstream into from a pricing perspective in terms of the cost of that actual product where you can send it and distribute it, how do you create that sense of community where you get people interested in the intangibles of supporting that neighborhood, supporting that local community?
Thanks. I take that? So I think we really experienced this with TaskRabbit, actually, where it's a business where people are essentially sharing time, right? So I can hire a background-checked person to do something for me. And I think what's really powerful about this and Zimride and Relay Rides and a lot of these other places where you're finding these neighborhoods and redefining the neighborhood is actually the power of the narrative. And what I was really struck by was just the degree to which people want to share the stories of what happens within these platforms. So as a really great example, there's a woman in San Francisco whose son suddenly had to go through chemotherapy in Boston. And she really couldn't get out to Boston in time. And so she hired a TaskRabbit to go to her son's hospital and deliver a basket of Whole Foods every day. And the person who picked it up on the other side was another mom. And she would call the other mom in San Francisco every day, tell her what her son looked like, and give her updates. And the power of that story, which was then spread in some publications and just people talked about it a lot, I thought was just one of the best things about this type of platform. And it's the reason why companies like TaskRabbit can hire really early on when they have very few resources, when they only have funding from people like me, right? And we can hire amazing engineers, we can hire amazing business people into our companies because you can tell people stories like that. And one of our customers in Zimride actually said to me, when I open my door, something magical happens. And I always love that, right? Like, that's the concept of the neighborhood. What it used to be that you'd open your door to your neighbors and you'd share a cup of sugar with them, or, you know, you'd have some kid across the street mow your lawn. We're actually recreating that through an online platform. The magic of this is that an online platform is creating offline interactions, and they're meaningful interactions. And I think that's the power of what we're providing.
Yeah, I mean, I can almost, we have probably thousands of, you know, of stories like this, and it gets at something bigger, right? It gets at something that this is beyond, you know, a bunch of startups building a business. It's actually this very big sort of global paradigm shift in the way that we think about the world and the way we think about our neighbors. And for Airbnb, the beauty of it is that it's cross-cultural. So, to see people, you know, we're probably going to be the first company in the entire world to bring people from every country around the world and have them go and actually stay with people from every other country around the world. When that happens, you start to break down barriers and sort of prejudices against, you know, cultures and communities. And, you know, there are so many stories like that. It really gets at something that is bigger than, you know, bigger than just, you know, people sharing stuff. I think it's around this emotional appeal.
I guess I'll just add, I'll agree and add one thing, or a challenge for us. It is all about creating connections and meaningful human interactions. So if you know, if you look at our website, it's impossible not to realize that the car belongs to a person. It's not a generic Prius. It's Shelby's Prius. And please respect it, because otherwise, you know, he will be, you know, he'll be personally, you know, inconvenienced, as opposed to, you know, some fleet manager having to, you know, to clean a car. So it's, you know, we've really been, you know, very conscious about, you know, about trying to emphasize and foster sort of that person-to-person relationship. And, you know, for us, it's also been a little bit challenging, because we have to balance sort of this community with convenience. And so, you know, people with mobility, they want to get in the car and they want to go. And so, you know, providing this, an electronic access, you don't actually get that face-to-face interaction. But we did just launch a, you know, key exchange program where you don't install anything in the car and you actually meet up and exchange the keys. And so some people have criticized us for, you know, taking a step backwards and taking a low-tech approach. But I think it is really exciting in that it actually is, you know, for us, we're finally creating this face-to-face, peer-to-peer interaction. So I'm really excited to see how this develops, and I think it will have a really meaningful impact on the strength of the community.
Yeah, the low-tech approach can be really cool. I rented a car from a neighbor, and she gave me a tour of her aquaponics system. It was really cool, and like gave me a strawberry, and it was like, yeah, with a strawberry on top. That you're not going to get that at Enterprise, right?
Exactly.
So,
thank you. my question's for Anne, but anybody could also field it. You said the B2B potential is rather high. Any businesses that target small, medium-sized businesses, SMBs, particularly effectively, and what makes them so effective in servicing SMBs?
Yeah, so, I mean, I would say two of our companies actually do that, right? So TaskRabbit, again, is one where small, medium businesses have actually been using them for a while. There's some dog store in Boston that has been using them for deliveries of their sort of high-end products to people who like to spend a lot of money on their dogs. And so, you know, you see a lot of that within even consumer platforms. The other one is Liquid Space, where we provide basically a passport and visa to a person who's looking for space, right? And you can say, I'm looking for a meeting space, and use Liquid Space to basically be able to find flexible space in a very short amount of time. And I think, again, that for us was, we were going through looking at enterprise as a potential opportunity in the sharing space. And Mark came to us with this idea, and it was just sort of very natural for us to want to be able to invest in it, because we'd started to see sort of this motion within, a natural inclination within the business space. If you want to ask more, he's right there.
That's Mark. Mark, raise your hand. Mark of Liquid Space.
Hi, I want to ask, I guess, a bit of a semantic question about sharing and the sharing economy. It seemed like we started with Zipcar, which is maybe more efficient, but it's basically new rental. And so that, to me, that's not really sharing compared to like Relay Rides, which is neighbors shares the car with us. So there is, you know, actual sort of mutualism there. Is there a jump you foresee to, you know, we owning a car in common as opposed to this person sharing with us, or even, you know, a small fleet of cars and vans, you know, at that community level? And then likewise with time and skills, there's already, you know, this concept of time banking that's been around for a long time, where there's not even an exchange of money. It is just that neighborhood-based sort of mutualism. Do you see this type of thing also moving in that direction, that it's truly mutual and truly shared? As thank you.
Okay. Yeah, who wants to jump on that one?
So I'll first address that. The first thing I will say is that I do think Zipcar is definitely sharing. Whenever they were IPOing, a lot of analysts were covering it and saying, you know, let's call a spade, this is short-term car rental. And I don't agree with that. The reason is because, you know, it's Zipcar is about mobility and transportation. It's frequently, for many people, it's their primary form of mobility. And, you know, car rental, on the other hand, it's for sort of unusual circumstances. You're traveling, your car breaks down. It's not sort of a day-to-day thing. And so, you know, that's why Zipcar has its cars in, you know, right in your neighborhoods. And the same thing for us. You know, it's, we try to provide people mobility, and you're sharing these assets. So, you know, I think car sharing is something that's very different than car rental. And I do think that, you know, that Zipcar, it does embody that. So, you know, I think you know, we take it a little bit further and sort of make it more about the community, and I think it's a more efficient use of resources. And you know, because our business model doesn't have high overhead, we can actually start to move outside of some of these dense urban areas. So in terms of, you know, we were asking about, you know, actual literal shared ownership, I think it is something that we could see one day. I think the way that we're thinking about it, and something that wouldn't be surprising for us to do in the non-distant future, is to have sort of closed sharing circles. So you know, you can own a car, and you can sort of have it only accessible to, you know, a very small group of people. And you can actually do this right now by only approving requests from you know, from people within this sort of very small group. You know, I think that there is sort of a legal challenge in terms of thinking about how do you actually facilitate a literal shared ownership of something. And it becomes, you know, so I think that we can get there. I think it's a little bit more complicated than sort of trying to have one person, you know, literally own the car and have other people sort of you know, share it and sort of share those costs. So I think that, you know, that's sort of what we're seeing. I wouldn't be surprised to see you know, literal shared ownership of a car. You know, just I think for us it's about providing more options and more flexibility.
I think, too, Shelby, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of the early car sharing was actually done, why not, technically as a shared ownership. It functioned essentially as a shared ownership with 6, 7, or 8 people getting together and saying...
Yeah, like car clubs, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Cooperatives, yeah.
It was 1996 in Portland, I think, was when it sort of was first being seen in the U.S. and starting in Switzerland. So I think there's... I think the fact that that never gained as much traction as what's going on right now is, like, you have to look and say, why did that happen? And I think there's an element in that... We have a fear of what happens if something goes wrong. How do we deal with that? And I think when, you know, and Anne was talking about, and this is in the old days, we used to, like, know our neighbors. We used to be more used to having to, we weren't as like a litigious, you know, a litigious society. We used to understand how to sort of interact with each other, deal with problems, and solve problems with each other just through communication. And I think now, you know, we've run into a situation where we're not as good at doing that, and so we tend to look more toward, you know, I need someone in between. I want to have a broker, and because I don't want to necessarily, if something goes wrong with my neighbor, you know, we have a bad business transaction, how do we, you know, handle that? I don't think that's to say that we shouldn't do it. I'm just saying I think that's maybe like why we've gotten to the place that we have.
Yeah, I mean, the fractional ownership industry is actually a gigantic industry. It's really big, but mm-hmm. it typically deals with assets that are like more expensive than cars. So mm-hmm. jets and real estate, mm-hmm. boats. And so there are a couple applications out there like jointly, and ZenShare that deal with that. I personally consulted before I started Shareable with a company called Divi.com, and it was, you know, car sharing in a sort of shared ownership thing, and it was just very difficult, and we ended up folding the business. It's really hard to get the traction to get, you know, so you have to have someone that is willing to like be the champion for the group and organize it, and you have to have contracts, and so it's a little more complicated and difficult market challenge.
I mean, I think it's also, you know, we talked about it too in terms of looking at which sharing platforms have gotten the most traction, and sort of looking from like the hyper-local all the way up to the national or international. And at the moment, it seems as though, for whatever reason, sort of the larger markets, the national, international, got more traction than us trying to share literally with each other in our own homes or in our own apartment complexes. And so I think, to me, that's one of the most interesting areas to look at and to study, is to understand how do we actually share at the more hyper-local level, because that's the thing that most like, we're most intuitively understand, the story of the blue couch, I think, and sort of how do we understand, you know, it's like if someone wants to, you know, sell a couch that's right next to me in New York City and it's on my hallway, you know, I may not know about that. And so it makes so much more sense to do that than to travel all around and looking for someone across the city on Craigslist. So I think it's a really interesting area to explore, and it'll be interesting in the next 2 or 3 years with more traction.
Yep. Question?
I just wanted to say that's where these platforms seem to add the most value is on the national level. And at the local level, I wanted to chime in. There's a great book, The Sharing Solution by Janelle Orsi, that addresses a lot of these social and legal frameworks for sharing at the community level. So thank you very much.
Yeah, right. And we should point out, too, is that you don't necessarily need a technology to share. There's, you can organize these things yourself, though these services can in many ways increase safety and convenience for people. And so we have another question.
Hey, firstly, I want to say to Christopher, thank you for me having a place to stay this weekend.
Can you speak up, please?
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
Michael, you can pull the mic down.
I know, right? There we go. My question is kind of linked to the hyperlocal stuff in a way, because I'm wondering what the role is for like public services in this landscape. So the work I do is kind of with public services and with their kind of financial constraints at the moment, like particularly in the UK, which is where I'm from, but I guess it's kind of an international trend. So something we're trying to do is match people who are like foodies, who really love to cook and make food at home, with like an older person who can't cook for themselves, or maybe somebody with a disability, and to try and kind of pair them together. But what I'm wondering is, could that work, and is that a thing, or is it actually like, because it's not really particularly reciprocal in a way, because an older person, they can give stuff back, but it will be different to food. How could that work, and what are your views on public services?
I'm happy to share my thoughts. I think part of it is, one, looking at it from, you know, is it just people swapping things, or is it, you know, who are built around a monetary and sort of capitalistic component. And I think if it's built around a capitalistic component and you're sort of, you know, providing economic opportunity to people, then yes, it can definitely happen. I think if you're just going to try and get people who cook and people who need food together and there's no money exchanging hands, it's going to be very difficult. We did a lot of research and we found that, you know, people on Airbnb, when they use the service or they, you know, sign up for the service, always are, you know, one, economically motivated, right? And I always break that down and call it the rational motivation for doing this. And then there are emotional appeals, and we sort of have, you know, kind of four core emotional appeals kind of across both being a traveler or a host that are, you know, completely different and almost evenly distributed amongst everyone using the site. But everyone is sort of initially rationally motivated to enter into this sort of new economy, and it's typically because of an economic reason. And I think if you can provide economic opportunity to people while making that possible, you know, then anything's possible. So,
yeah, we've actually seen some of that in TaskRabbit. There is a money exchange, so it's not pure public service. But as an example, people leaving a hospital and they need a ride home. We've seen it used for that. We've actually had blind customers who will then ask for TaskRabbit to do certain tasks around their home on a very regular basis. And so, you know, there's a lot of opportunities, especially as we build out our subscription services. We've seen it used on a more regular basis for things like this. Caretakers asking for an additional person to come into the house to help out.
So to play devil's advocate, I do agree with a lot of what you were saying, Chris. Frequently it is sort of that rational, spark, and we see that a lot in relay rides as well, of what gets people's attention and brings people into the community. There also is in contrast to Airbnb, couch surfing it's been around for a decade and has 4 million members, and there's absolutely no exchange of money. It's people doing things for completely different reasons, completely emotional reasons. And so, you've got to consider if you're thinking about it economically, what is the pain and why would somebody do this? And if not, really trying to figure out what are those emotional factors that people can latch onto. I think couchsurfing does show that you can have a huge community of millions of people that will do something, for these emotional factors.
I think you lose the point, though, that there's a reciprocation that happens there, which comes back to the rational appeal of I have to host you in order for me to go to Europe and backpack and stay for free. So,
There was a recent survey done by an advertising firm, and the key takeaway that I saw on that is that this was a mass consumer sort of survey. The key takeaway for me was that consumers, I don't like that word, but I say citizens, that citizens want value and meaning. They want it together. Yeah. And Paul Davis, yeah. Any questions from Twitter?
No further questions that I saw.
Okay. Shin from Trust Cloud, let's hear from you.
Hi. So do you think Qualcomm sites will ever enable portable trust? And I'm asking that because if I take care of your Prius, will I take care of your apartment, Chris? So if I take care of Shelby's Prius, right? And, can I take that with me the same way I can with a credit score?
I really hope that this happens. I think as I mentioned, trust and safety, I think, is one of the it's a prerequisite. We have to have a safe marketplace for people to use it. We're building a reputation within Relay Rides. So, it's very clear how, when Chris comes, as he uses the marketplace, how he's treated other people's cars. And, part of it can be used by other car owners to figure out if they want to rent to Chris. And part of it is used internally at Relay Rides. And we, sort of look for problems and we'll remove people from the marketplace, that aren't sort of adhering to the social norms that we're creating. But at the same time, I think that reputation can become amplified and much more powerful as it's shared across the different platforms. And so for two main reasons. One is I think that you would view your reputation as more meaningful. It's that, well, crap, if I mess up Chris's car, then I can't just go to Zipcar because my reputation is going to follow me. And they're going to see that I just don't respect people's things. So I think it can make it more powerful. And the second thing is that it can also help to sort of kickstart your reputation on another service. So if you come into Relay Rides, it could be sort of this cycle where people won't rent to you because you don't have a reputation, but you can't but because you don't so then it keeps going. If it is meaningful that you behave on Airbnb. And so we can look at that. You can at least see that, hey, this person has sort of a history or tendency of behaving well. So there is a lot of activity. I think there's, I've spoken with a lot of other founders within the sharing economy, and everybody sees this as a major win. So I think it's definitely going to happen. I'm very supportive and excited to see this.
So one question I would have is that for a long time, the reason why these sort of central repositories haven't happened is that once a larger company sort of emerges where that reputation becomes a central part of their platform, that becomes sort of their key IP, right? And so why would they want to help another company sort of build up their business on the backs of what you've created, right? And so there is a challenge there. I mean, I've invested in sharing economy companies. I would love to see it happen, but a lot of times people don't want to share that, right? So
I'm just going to throw a hypothetical out there. We've now done well over 5 million nights booked. So those 5 million nights booked come with a lot of reviews and a lot of sort of reputation data, with what is probably for everyone the most intimate asset you could possibly imagine sharing, which is your home. So to share a car or to share a power drill or anything else is sort of, you know, it wouldn't really, you know, it's sort of non plus compared to to renting your home to someone. So that reputation data that we have is incredibly powerful. And we also have a massive community, globally of millions of people. So in that regard, for us, it is very much the backbone and the tenet of our marketplace, right? It's what makes our marketplace work. We kind of have the belief that there won't be 1,000 marketplaces across the internet for people to share. There'll be a few. There'll be an Amazon of sharing. I think that isn't necessarily, us saying that it's going to be Airbnb, but I think it's just sort of the evolution of the internet is that people won't go to 1,000 different websites to share, especially if sharing becomes an everyday part of life. It's homes, cars, power drills. I'm not going to go to 10 websites in order to do that those daily activities. I'm going to go to one. And I think that is sort of, probably the future of sharing.
Okay, so we've got about 2 more minutes. We'll take these 2 questions if they're really concise, and we give one answer here, okay?
Okay. Well, my question is, what are your best practices on creating this environment of trust and safety from day one? So you just launched the platform, and the demand has to be created. What are your best practices on creating such a platform?
Who wants to answer
safety
this one?
And trust. Thank you.
So I think the most important thing is thinking about them separately as trust and safety. So you have to have systems that keep people safe, so that are backstops. So for us, it's insurance, it's screening driving records, it's doing fraud and identity theft checks. So actually having mechanisms that make it safe. And thinking about that trust very differently. It's about creating a meaningful identity and a reputation and norms, and really stressing those norms at every step. So, making sure that you're not sort of confusing them, but they are very different things.
Okay, one more quick question.
One more, about the future. It's partially answered already with the Amazon of sharing, but how do you think that this kind of future will be? How do we move towards that? Is it more like one big player emerging or one current player spreading up to sharing all kind of things in the service? Or do you see more possibilities for collaboration between services and like time sharing and car sharing services joining forces or somehow collaborating?
Yeah, who wants to take a shot at that?
I mean, just from a pure business standpoint, I mean, if you look at the history of the way that industries develop, is that you have a lot of small players, and then over time they naturally want to aggregate. And as Chris was saying, as this becomes a more fundamental part of your life, I can't see it developing in another way. Right? I can't go to 10 websites to create all the different transactions. It's got to sort of come together. And I think Anne's point is really interesting, is whether or not the trust side of it is going to reside within a big on the business side and within one of those actual platforms. If it's going to be something that exists within like a regulatory body more on like on the government side, and that's I think further on down the line. I think that's an interesting thing that will develop over time.
Right. Okay. So
can I just say something real quick?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. I'll let you finish now.
Well, we got to end. It's the end of the panel. So just one quick message for braving the weather in the early morning panel. I would like to extend a personal invitation to Shareable Magazine's party on Monday, March 12th at 5:30 p.m. at Cheer Up Charlie's, sponsored by Relay Rides and Trust Cloud and a bunch of other